This is the Financial Sense News Hour with the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. Now, here's the Financial Sense News team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Greetings, everyone. Happy New Year, and welcome to the first Financial Sense News Hour program of the year. As always, during the holiday weekend of New Year's, we do a special program, and the special program this year is a presentation of a series of addresses done at the Financial Sense Investment Strategy Conference last November, which originally was only available to conference attendees and Jim's clients. And to lead us through this seminar is Jim Poplava.
Let's go ahead and get started. Let me get through the legal stuff. This keeps the lawyers, the SEC, FINRA, and all the nice guys that we have to deal with. That just basically says we have three companies, a broker-dealer, an RIA, in Financial Sense. The other thing is, if I say something, I believe, I anticipate, I think, that is not a guarantee. So make sure that everybody understands that. And past performance, if I ever talk about the stock market, what it's done in the past doesn't mean it's going to do that in the future. Before we do that, we'd like to make some introductions of some new staff members to our firm. Becky Sutton joined us this year. She's a CFA. She has a bachelor's degree in business, a master's. She also got her CFA in 2000, spent 15 years with Brandis Investments. The next person is Paul Horn. Paul Horn joins us. He has a master's degree in financial analysis. He's passed his first CFA exam. He's a certified financial planner, and Paul joins us from J.P. Morgan Private Wealth. So two new members to our staff. Now, what we're going to do in the first hour is give you a 40,000-foot view of the world today. We're going to talk about global economics. We're going to talk about the economy here, overseas, and everybody's favorite subject, the Federal Reserve. That's about all we've been talking about this year. Will she or will she not? Will she not? We think she's probably going to go in December if things continue as they are. Many of you saw the unemployment report yesterday, dropped to 5%, 270,000 jobs, the stock market's going up. So it looks like, unless there's some disaster between now and then. So we'll be talking about Fed policy. What does it mean for the stock market? And also global economics, because as many people thought, the Fed was going to raise interest rates in September, and for the first time, the Fed made mention of what was going on overseas, because we are living in an interconnected world today. What goes on over there impacts what's happening here. You're probably going to see more charts than you've ever seen in your life, so we'll be passing out 3D glasses here in just a minute. Well, let's talk about what we're going to be emphasizing today. In past client meetings, I usually try to walk away with one particular theme of the meeting. What are the main topics? What are the big things, the bigger picture that we want you focused on? In the past, 2009, lessons from history about bubbles. 2010, we addressed the inflation deflation. 2011, we've been here. 2012, a message we really want to emphasize, don't fight the Fed. Also, more things that are right than wrong, and still more things are right about this country than any other country in the world right now. Stay in our backyard was the theme for 2014. If there's one message I want you to walk away from in this meeting today, is we are preparing for the final phase of the bull market, which could be some of the best days of the stock market. I know a lot of you are thinking, how can that be? But technicians will tell you the stock markets have five waves. The first wave, the smart money gets in, then you have a correction. The second wave, institutions get in, then you have a correction. The third wave, everybody gets in. Think of 1997 to 2000, or the stock market between 2005 and 2007. we believe we are now about to enter the final phase of the bull market. Now, whether that lasts 1 year, 2 years, or 3 years is really in the hands of the Federal Reserve. And you're going to see, just as we have seen unusual monetary policy this last 10 years, you're going to see unusual tightening policy in the next 3 or 4 years. It's going to be gradual, it's going to be slow, and it's going to be nowhere near what it once was in the past. There's no way they're going up to 5%. The bad news for you as savers, interest rates are going to remain low, extremely low, for an extended period of time. Just as, if many of you are aware, Japan has had interest rates at almost 0.25% for 2 decades. If you think about us here, we've been at 0% interest rates for 7 years. Well, let's talk about the first hour. We're going to cover the business cycle, what to expect when the Fed is raising interest rates, and then we're going to take a look at a global view of the economy. Now, if you look at economic cycles, they correspond with Fed rate raising cycles. There's 4 cycles to an economic expansion. The early phase, think of 2009 to 2012. The mid phase of the business cycle, which is where we think we're in now, that's from 2012 to the present. And then the late stage, which is where we think we're heading into as we get into 2016, maybe 2017. Now, the 4 phases of the business cycle, the early stage is the recovery. As I mentioned, that's 2009 to 2012. This is where we think we are now. We are in that mid cycle of the business cycle heading into what eventually will be a economic contraction. Despite all the proclamations made by the Federal Reserve and all the politicians, they have yet to repeal the business cycle. At some point in the future, we're going to have another recession and we'll probably have another bear market. But we think right now we're right in this sweet spot right here. And believe it or not, the final phase of a bull market can be a very good one, even though the economy underneath is slowing down. You might have thought back to the tech boom. And actually, from 1997 to 2000, earnings were beginning to decline for many companies. What was going up was there was so much money flowing into the market, people were just simply willing to pay more to buy a share of stock. But earnings were actually starting to go into decline. Now, why do we think we're in the mid-cycle part of the economy? Some of the things that you see in a mid-cycle, personal income going up, non-farm payroll employment, the unemployment rate just hit 5% yesterday. We've come down remarkably in 7 years from 10.2. Now, a lot of people would argue, well, the participation rate, there's less people participating in the economy today. Part of that has to do with baby boomers that are heading into retirement. Retail sales, industrial production are strong. And one of the reasons the Fed is talking about raising interest rates is credit growth is starting to pick up. How many of you bought a new car and financed it in the last couple of years? Did you get a good rate? 0% on many. And so credit is starting to flow through the economy. And that is what carries an economy and can give us future economic expansion. Auto loans are at almost record levels. The auto companies have been reporting third quarter earnings. They're at record levels. And we are annualizing at an annual rate of 18 million vehicles sold a year. I mean, it's a good time to be a car dealer. Now, as you get through the mid-cycle of a business cycle, things begin to happen. One thing that happens is profit at companies begins to peak. One of the reasons, wages are going up. And we've seen over the last couple months, corporation after corporation saying that they're going to begin raising wages. From Walmart, which is raising the minimum wage to $11, to Costco, to Target, to just about every single company. The other thing that happens during this phase is we can see here, this is the federal funds rate. It's been at zero for 7 years. When you start getting into the final phase of the bull market and the final phase of the economy, the Fed begins to raise interest rates. Many would argue that stopping tapering was a form of tightening. Because remember, when the Fed was tapering, think about this. 80 billion dollars of money was flowing into the financial markets on a monthly basis. In 2014, they put about $750 billion. In 2013, it was $1.2 trillion. That's a lot of money. The Fed's balance sheet has expanded by $4 trillion. And now what the Fed started is now become global. The ECB is advancing quantitative easing. They will continue to do that. Interest rates in Europe on bonds 7 years and under are actually negative. Can you imagine borrowing money? So I go to you and I ask you to lend me money. You say, okay, Jim, I'll lend you money. And then I can say, but I'm going to charge you to lend me money. How many of you take up on that? That's what's going on in the markets right now. So some of the characteristics that you see as you leave the mid-cycle and then into the late cycle, profits begin to peak and the Fed begins to raise interest rates. Now, one of the things we monitor very close is the leading economic indicators. And that includes everything from the work week to jobless claims, orders for capital goods, the stock market, manufacturing. The two things that are diverging in our economy right now is the ISM manufacturing index is close to 50. Anything below 50 indicates a contracting economy. And one of the reasons that we're seeing a slowdown in manufacturing is the strength of the U.S. dollar. Because if you're selling goods overseas, the dollar has strengthened by over 38% against most of the major currencies of the world, which is wreaking havoc around the globe. The other thing that happens in the final cycle is credit begins to tighten. Banks know that in the late stage of a cycle, things begin to slow down, so they institute usually tougher lending standards. The exception to that was the real estate bubble in the last decade when everything just got crazy. Something else, and this I want to focus some time on because this is a key graph. This is the federal funds rate. And if you can see right up here, this is 1999 to 2000. The Fed raised interest rates, the Fed funds rate at 6.5%. Dropped them precipitously, kept them there low, and brought it down to 1%. Folks, we're at 0.25% and zero. We're not even close to where Greenspan started raising interest rates. In the next cycle, Greenspan was only able to raise it to close to 5% before we had a financial crisis. Now, when the Fed meets, they put something out called the dot plot. The dot plot is the consensus of Fed governors where they think interest rates are going to be in the future. I want to show you something. Okay, 6.5, 5. They started out at 3.5. We're at 2.6. The market says they'll only get to 1.4. So the bad news for a saver is the days of high interest rates are gone for a considerable period of time. They're going to be with us for the remainder of this decade. Now, I have a theory, and this is just conjecture on my part, but as we get to the end of this cycle, one of the reasons they're not going to get much higher than this is when the president leaves office, we will have $20 trillion in debt as a country. Think about it. His presidency will have doubled the debt than all of his predecessors combined. His predecessor, George Bush, doubled the national debt from $5 trillion to $10 trillion. Obama will double it to $20 trillion. The average rate of interest on the government right now of all its debt is about 2%. Now, think of what happens to our deficit. Now, here's an interesting statistic. In 2014, the government's fiscal year, the government of the United States paid $430 billion in interest expense. What makes that fascinating is in 2008, the government spent $450 billion in interest with $8 trillion less in debt. For every 1% increase in interest rates, it costs the government $200 billion in additional debt. So imagine if we got back to the 5% rate, that would cost the government alone $1 trillion a year in interest. And what I think you will see happen, and this is speculation on my part, and you saw the disclaimer, so that doesn't mean it'll happen. But I think as we get further out, 2018, 2019, you will see another round of quantitative easing as the Fed begins to monetize much of the government debt, because as interest rates begin to rise, the deficit will begin to explode again because of not only increasing entitlements with the boomers heading into retirement, but higher interest rates on a $20 trillion debt. So that's one reason why I think this is a key graph. It really tells you this is where they started. This is where they think. And by the way, this comes down just about every FOMC meeting. And this is where the market, and the market has been more accurate in reflecting where the Fed is going. We believe there's still a lot of life in this economy, and two sectors, major sectors of the economy, are doing very well right now as a reflection of lower interest rates: automobile sales and housing. And if we take a look at housing, 30-year fixed rate mortgages are below 4%. Here's an interesting statistic, if you like these kind of things. Interest rates are lower today than they were under Hammurabi. Think about that for a minute. They're lower today, the lowest interest rates in 5,000 years of human history. So we are living truly in historical times. Currently, mortgage payments average about 12.4 versus 20, so this housing market still has a lot of life to it. If you look at builder confidence, demand, and supply, the other thing is builders aren't putting out a lot of homes on speculation today. They're controlling inventory, controlling prices, which is one reason we've seen price increases. I think year over year, we're up about 4% nationally on the price of homes. Housing snapshot, consumer balance sheets are in great shape. Payroll job growth is strong. Employers are raising wages. And of course, the lowest mortgage rates in history. Here's an interesting statistic. The average age of an automobile in this country is 11 years. One of the reasons you're seeing strong sales now is the fleet has to be replaced. And with low gas prices, here's another interesting one. We can see here the number of miles is at a record level. So Americans are driving more today. Now, we place a lot of emphasis on the economy. And one of the reasons why is you want to know where the stock market's going, follow where the economy's going. Because you think about a recession. What happens in a recession? Sales begin to fall. As sales begin to fall, what happens to profits of companies? Profits go down. When profits go down, what do companies do? They lay off workers. Laid off workers spend less money. So you take a look at, this is the stock market. If you take a look at every downturn in the stock market, these pink bars are recessions. So there was the big financial tech boom bust. We were in a recession. There was the financial crisis. There was a recession. So we pay a lot of attention to the economy because it's only natural. If the economy begins to slow down, if it begins to contract, you're going to see less sales, less profits, higher unemployment. So it's only natural that you would see a downturn in stocks. Other factors that we see that are doing very well, durable good orders, those are big ticket items. We're not even close to where we used to be. We're still not even close to average. It's still in an uptrend. As we're seeing with the unemployment, unemployment claims continue to fall. These aren't the kind of things that you see in a recession. We always try to get differences of opinion on our program. We have some guests that are predicting a recession next year. We do not find ourselves in the recession camp, and we'll show you why. Housing strong, automobiles are strong, durable good consumption, unemployment claims are falling, wages are going up. Those aren't characteristic. Now, there's 12 Federal Reserve districts. Each one of those districts publishes a report every month. There's two we pay a lot of attention to. One is the Philly Fed Index, which tracks the economic growth rates of all 50 states in the country. The other one is the Chicago Fed, which tracks 85 composite indicators. This is all 50 states of the country right now. You notice the lime green and the green. What does that mean? It means those states have growing economies. But you can see there's only three states that have problems right now. Wyoming, North Dakota. What do you think? Oil, shale oil. Louisiana. As we leave the economic section, as we look at the United States economy is still going strong. We're not growing at the rates that we did in the past. Too much taxes, too much regulation, and too much debt. You simply cannot grow an economy with that much debt, that tax rate, and then also with the number of regulations. Now let's move on to talk about the Federal Reserve. What's interesting, when interest rates first start to rise, believe it or not, stocks do well, because what is that signaling to investors? The Fed is basically saying, you know what? The economy is strong enough now to stand on its own legs. We can raise interest rates a little bit. So it's usually a sign of a confidence. It's why when the Fed didn't raise interest rates in September, we saw another downturn in the market, because everybody was saying, okay, the economy's finally good. You guys are going to start raising interest rates. Oh, nope, we're not. It's not so good. There's problems overseas. So normally, if you look historically, within a interest rate cycle, within 2 years, the market's up 22%. That's why we expect a good year-end finish, barring some unforeseen catastrophe. If you are listening to the podcast today, I had my good friend Ralph Ancampora on the program, and I was asking him, I said, in August, what were you thinking? He said, well, I was curled in the fetal position underneath my bed. But I talked to Ralph. He thinks a strong finish. And he also likes the markets going forward. He believes we're in a secular bull market. Now, a lot of people are saying they've been predicting crashes. They've been predicting a number of things. I hate to tell, we've had a bear market. I don't know if people realize between 2000 and 2013, the S&P went nowhere. Nowhere. If you were just looking at the index itself, it had a zero return in 13 years, much like the Japanese stock market. It wasn't until April 2013 that we finally exceeded the previous highs reached in October of 2007 and March of 2000. But all assets rise together when the Fed begins to raise interest rates. And I'll tell you why we think stocks are heading higher. And yes, folks, gold will be going up as well. Once again, that's not guaranteed. Why the Fed didn't raise in September, and what really took the markets by surprise, is for the first time the Fed mentioned difficulties that were occurring in the emerging world. And we'll get into later on, one of the reasons they did that is there's $9.2 trillion of dollar-denominated loans in the world today. So what happens if you borrowed, let's say you're in Korea, you're in Thailand, and you borrowed in dollars? Your currency is going down. What happens? You owe the banks more money. If you're in India and your currency is down 36%, the value of your loan just went up 36%. You owe the banks 36% more money. And that's one of the reasons why we're having some difficulties right now. And it was why the IMF and the World Bank was telling Janet, please, please don't raise interest rates right now. There's $9.2 trillion of debt. You raise interest rates, what does that do to the dollar? It strengthens the dollar, which means the higher the dollar goes, the more those people owe on their loans, and there's going to be massive defaults. So that's why the Fed, in many ways, even though we're the world's central bank, we are the world's reserve currency, they are constrained by events overseas, because what happens to the dollar? They fear a rising dollar because of the impact it has on debt. Now, if you look at Fed rate raising cycles, one of the reasons why we think this one's going to be different, in the past, you've had inflation at 2.5%, which is 0.5% above the Fed's target. They begin raising once the rate of inflation exceeds that. 80% of global economic indicators are in positive territory. You look at today, inflation at about 2.2%, only 0.58% of the indicators are rising today. So not the ideal condition for raising interest rates, and it's one of the reasons. And I think one of the things the Fed keeps talking about this, they know sooner or later that we're going to have a recession. They know sooner or later they may have to lower interest rates. I think the real reason they're trying to raise interest rates is to get some bullets back into the chamber, so if we get into another crisis, they have the ability to lower rates. These are deflation rates around the country and around the world. And as you can see, the general trend of we're more in a deflationary cycle as a result of a rising dollar. Just take a look at commodity prices from the peak. Good news, oil is down 67%. Copper 51%, silver, aluminum, dollar up 38%. As you can see here, this is creating problems globally around the world. China is also slowing down. China's growth rate averaged 12 to 13% in the last decade. They just reported they lowered their estimates to 6.5. People that follow details in China, they don't exactly publish stuff the way we'd like to see them here in the West. They think the underlying growth rate in China is probably closer to 3.5%. But why China has had a significant impact on the world just as much as the U.S. has, and especially for commodity-producing countries, take a look at the amount of commodities that China consumes. 60% of the world's concrete, 48% of copper, 46% of steel, 13% of uranium. You can see here nickel and even gold. So China is a major consumer of commodities. And by the way, one thing we like that's bullish for oil is despite the slowdown in the economy, Chinese imports of oil are up year over year by 8%. Once a Chinese goes from a bicycle to a motor scooter to a car, he's a permanent consumer of oil. Emerging markets, here's the problem the IMF and the World Bank is talking about. The Brazil real is down 63%. Against the dollar. Imagine if you have $1 million loan and you're a Brazilian company and it's denominated in dollars. Are you in a world of hurt right now? Big hurt. But here's the problem, and this is a good way to illustrate it. Here's the $9.2 trillion that I talked about on debt right here. This is dollar-denominated debt. If you were in Brazil and you borrowed money in dollars, this is what you now owe versus this is what you borrowed. So you can see the problems why Brazil's debt is being downgraded because of what's happening to their currency. One of the things that came out that surprised everybody at the Fed meeting in September was the Fed basically for the first time realized if they raised interest rates with the stock market falling precipitously, and it wasn't just here, it was global, but also the loans, what was happening domestic, the domestic economy started to weaken, mainly on the manufacturing side coming from a stronger dollar. Financial market volatility. Last thing you do when you have fire going on in a building is to pour more gasoline on it. And that's what would have happened. That's why they had to pull back. Now, where are we in the Fed rate raising cycle? Just as we talked about four cycles in the economy, early, mid, late stage, and then recession, there are four stages in a Fed rate raising cycle. This is where you are at a recession. In a recession, you have tight monetary policy. The Fed begins to ease. Here's where we've been basically since 2007 in an easing and easing cycle. Rates were coming down to zero and the Fed was printing money. We think we're moving to phase one. And believe it or not, phase one, the two best phases to be invested in stocks are actually phase four and phase one. You can see here the rate of return has been positive. The one that you have to really worry about is when the Fed really starts getting into tightening. And I want you to think of 2005 to 2007. They were trying to get the Fed funds rate. The mortgage market was going crazy. Real estate prices were going crazy. Stocks were going crazy. Inflation rates were heading up to 5%. So they kept raising interest rates at every single cycle. It's the fourth phase of the market and the rate raising cycle. At this point, the economy's in recession. And it isn't declared a recession. It's usually a lag. But that's a time that you want to get more defensive when it comes to investing. We think we are right here. We're moving from this phase to this phase. And this phase is still bullish for stocks. Now I want to take a look at what's going on globally. This has confused a lot of economists. Why haven't we had hyperinflation? I mean, the Fed printed, think about this, the Fed printed $4 trillion. Now, when I got in the business in 1980, we used to call them the M&Ms, M1, M2, M3. We used to watch them every Thursday. And if the money supply went up, interest rates went up. Well, think about it. Interest rates are not going up, and we're not seeing hyperinflation. How can that be? We printed $4 trillion. The Europeans are printing $1 trillion. Japan is printing trillions. And we think China may possibly result to QE if they can't turn their economy around. The reason is technology, demographics, and deleveraging. What happens when you're deleveraging? Are you expanding credit? No, you're contracting credit, whether by default or the pay down of debt. What happens with technology? This you're going to find fascinating. Let's begin with demographics. Once again, I guess you have to come maybe from my background. I'm actually the first generation born American. My parents came from Europe. And you really appreciate this country. A good friend of mine who has traveled all over the world, he says, you know what? I've been all over the place. The U.S. still is the best place in the world to live. And the great thing about the U.S. is we have the best demographics of any major nation around the world. And you can see that right there is demographics. This is China. And you noticed in the last couple of weeks, China announced a new policy. You can now have two kids instead of one in China. The reason is they recognize the demographics of the country are falling precipitously. And look at Europe. It's even worse. Demographics, what happens when you have less people? Less people consuming. It's less economic growth. Let's talk about technology for a moment. Look at the desktop in 1980. Look at the desktop today. How many of you listen to the podcast? The amazing thing that strikes me about the podcast is when I first went on radio, I used to have to go down to the station and you have this big switchboard, microphones, booms, and more switches than I know what to do with. Then I started to do it remotely and we had these big boxes, amplifiers, equipments, mic, headset. Today, I can do my podcast anywhere in the world with simply an iPad and an iPhone. That's it. I actually did several of my interviews last year in December in a hotel room with an iPhone, which was plugged in, a phone from the studio that I could hear my guest. And I had a headphone set on with a mic in my iPad hooked up to Wi-Fi, pressed a button and sent my voice into the studio. Now, here's another one that'll blow your mind. This iPhone has more computational power than NASA computers that sent astronauts to the moon in 1969 and brought them back home safely. This phone. Think about that for a moment. This little device right here, more powerful than everything that NASA had at its disposal in 1969. Technology is disruptive. And today we're going through a technological revolution every 7 years. Take a look at the cost of computation and storage. It's down to about 2 cents. Take a look at what technology has done. We used to use headhunters to hire. It would cost me 30% of a salary to pay the headhunter to hire personnel. Today, it cost me $300 on LinkedIn. Major savings. Take a look at what iPhone did to the digital camera in the camcorder. Ask your kids if they even know what a camcorder is. Digital music. Look how Apple changed the music industry. Anybody see the keynote event? I think it was last September, October, when they had U2 on stage with Tim Cook. That was the single largest introduction of a music album in the history of the world. That album was made free as a download to 500 million subscribers. Now, if you're a rock band, how would you like to launch an album to 500 million subscribers? I would say they did real well. Take a look at Uber, what it's doing to transportation. Airbnb. We have a client, has a house, rents out 3 bedrooms, young couple, no kids, they rent out 3 of their bedrooms. They make enough money renting out their rooms to pay for their mortgage. Take a look what's happening to hotel space. It's one of the reasons why cities are against this, because what did the cities do in the financial crisis? They kept raising the cost and fees. Have you ever stayed at a hotel? And I love this. You call the hotel and they go, oh, it's $199 a room. And then you get there and you find out the fees, the ground fees, the taxes and everything. Next thing you know, you're paying $270. And even worse, they're charging you for parking, valet, and a bunch of other stuff. So now Airbnb is bringing down the cost. So technology is bringing the cost down. Think of LED TVs. I remember the first one I bought was $6,000. Now you can get them for $400 or $500. Think of what you paid for. I remember the first DVD player I bought in 1998. I think it cost $700. Today you get HD players for what, $99? So technology is bringing down the cost. Demographics are bringing down the cost. And deleveraging is bringing down the cost. This one I find fascinating. This is technology. Look how quickly technology is being adopted here. Take a look at the tablet, the smartphone, social media. Take a look. We're condensing it into years versus decades when we brought in the telephone, electrification of the city, the introduction of automobiles. Take a look what's happened to energy production. I used to be in the peak oil camp. I still am. I think it's been postponed by decades with the introduction of shale and technology. And even in shale itself, we're bringing down the cost of shale production somewhere in the neighborhood of $45 to $50 a barrel. If you take a look at our trade deficit, one of the reasons it's improved is we're importing less oil. And one of the things that happened with shale is, number one, from the financial crisis of 2008 to currently, the U.S. is consuming about 4 million barrels less a day of oil. More fuel-efficient cars, technology improvements. On top of that, we have increased our oil production by over 4 million barrels a day. Do you realize that is the most significant impact on the oil market globally? It hasn't been OPEC. OPEC has not really increased its production significantly. It has been the U.S., and it's disrupted much of the power that OPEC once held on the markets. The bad news for those of you on Social Security, there will be no increases in Social Security for 2016. Zero inflation. So what we're seeing are low inflation rates despite the amount of money that's being created by central banks. Now I want to get into something about global trade that also I think the bears don't understand. If you take a look at global trade, they tell you it's contracting. That's false. It's actually growing. But if you measure global trade in terms of dollars, it's contracting, because if you have your currency, you're selling widgets and your currency is down 40%, 20%, what happens when you sell something in dollars? You're getting less money. If you look at quantity in terms of widgets out the door, it's actually growing. And you can see this right here. If you look at the quantity of GDP, meaning the number of goods produced, it's up 2.7%. You can see the consistency all across the board. If you take a look at price, you see the difference? And it's simply, let me put this in reverse. Let's say you sell a dollar of goods denominated in dollars, but you're getting paid in your currency and your currency is down 20%. The value of your currency in the dollars sold is actually going down because your currency is depreciating, even though the number of widgets going out the door is actually going up. Let's talk about monetary supply, and these next two graphs are key to what's coming. Right here in red is bank credit. What happens when bank credit contracts? This is the Fed's balance sheet. So if you looked at right here, here was bank credit down at the bottom. Here was when the Fed announced QE1. They announced QE1, bank credit began to expand, and then all of a sudden, it began to contract. The Fed launches QE2. Here we are right here. It started to contract again. And what does the Fed launch? QE3 and QE4. Here is where the Fed is right now in terms of expanding its balance sheet. Here's bank credit. It's still growing, but in a downward slope. You have not seen the end of QE. We will have QE5. And who knows what QE5 will be? It could be $2 trillion instead of $1 trillion. Maybe they print $100 billion a month. You can see the same thing when it comes to Europe. Here is the money supply in Europe. Notice as the money supply starts to contract, the ECB expands credit. And then here is Mario. Look at this. Here's what happens to the money supply in Europe. Europe went into a recession in 2011. Draghi launches QE in 2012. Remember the pig crisis in 2011? And then Draghi came out and he said, I'll do anything it'll take. Well, he came out with the bazooka. He didn't come out with the bazooka. He came out with the cannon. So here you have right now, the money supply is starting to contract again in Europe, which is why Draghi came out recently and said that and hinted at the possibility that they're going to expand credit. European credit is a terrible place to invest today because imagine paying the borrower an interest rate for him to borrow from you. I mean, negative interest rates. And they're going to be there for an extended period of time. But that's also good news if you're investing in European stocks because easy money is flowing in Europe. European stocks are cheaper and the dividend yields are higher. China, they've slashed interest rates. They've eased on mortgage requirements. They've added the two-baby policy. China's economy is slowing down and they may be the fourth major economic power to announce quantitative easing. The bad news for savers are you're going to be stuck with low interest rates for an extended period of time. We used to laugh at Japan. It's been going on there for two decades. It's almost going on here for a decade. And we see low interest rates, even though the Fed might raise, they're still going to remain relatively low for at least the next decade. Summary, where are we in the business cycle? We think we're in the mid-cycle, entering into the late-stage cycle, which is ahead of us. What to expect? You're going to see monetary policy begin to increase interest rates. It's going to be slow. It's going to be gradual. It's not going to be every FOMC meeting they're raising a quarter point. Just not going to happen. And I doubt seriously if they ever even get to maybe 1.5% on the Fed funds rate. Overview of global monetary policy. Emerging markets are still weakening at this point. Let's take a break.
Coming up next in part two of the 2015 Financial Sense Investment Strategy Conference with Jim Poplava, we'll take a look at valuations and Federal Reserve rate cycles, investing for the final phase of the expansion and the bull market, the case for active management, and preparing for the top. What are the signs when you reach it? Finally, strategies to mitigate risks in a mature bull market. If you have investment information questions, you may call us toll free, 888-486-3939, 888-486-3939, or go to our website, financialsense.com, as the Financial Sense Investment Strategy Conference continues.